profitability, we are not sustainable. And without sustainable profitability, we can't create a more sustainable solution. Without a doubt, life cycle assessments, taking product back at end of life, and using cleaner fibres and knowing your supply chain, if those are the simple ticks, should be worked on by medium to large size retailers. And that doesn't mean to say that you need to change your business model. It means that you just need to work towards those things, which is possible.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today, I'm going to be talking to Nick Reed, who is the founder of a climate-conscious menswear brand called Neem London, unsurprisingly based in London here in the UK. At the time I'm recording this, I've recently come back from a bunch of different events and trade shows where the Interline has been featured, and the relationship between product creation, materials, manufacturing, the way that consumers think about the way they buy product, what they buy product for, how long it needs to last, what it should be made of, what transparency means, what circularity means. These are all really big questions that are top of mind for me. So it was a lot of fun for me to spend a good kind of half hour or more talking with Nick about this as somebody who is on the ground leading a business that has a different business model, one that's a little bit out of lockstep with the way that fashion operates, but one that is also really calibrated for the core of what fashion should be doing, which is creating great products that people want to buy and using that to further a mission, using that to further their ability to make a difference. So you're going to hear me and Nick talk about Neem's business model. You're going to hear us talk about legislation. You're going to hear us talk about what it means to do domestic production and sourcing. You're going to hear us talk a lot about technology and how that influences those things. And you're going to hear Nick give some advice to companies who are in a similar space to his, i.e. smaller and growing and emerging brands who don't want to just perpetuate the existing system and want to use technology and innovation to try and make a difference, but to do it in a way that's measured and practical and achievable. Without further ado, over to my chat with Nick. Okay, Nick Reed, welcome to the Interline podcast. Start us off, tell us a little bit about yourself, a bit about your journey in fashion, and a bit about what your day-to-day looks like.
Yeah, super thrilled to be here with you. Thanks for having me. So my background is that I started a brand called Neem London 4 years ago. We've scaled to, we'll do about 400,000 with a good headwind in November, December this year. But prior to that, I was buying and brand director at Moss Bros. I served as acting MD at a small brand called Gandhi's for a while. And then I was buying a brand director for Charles Tirrett. I joined Charles Tirrett when they were quite small, which are a large sort of 450 million men's international fashion retailer. So I joined them when they were about turning over about 5 million. And I was there for 16 years and grew with them. So for a long time, I was buying and brand director, and then ended up at Tours the latter years there as creative director. Then I went to Moss, then I was at Gandhi's, and then I started Neem 4 years ago. So that's the sort of potted history in a minute or two. Just to develop that further, I was responsible at all sort of three larger businesses, Charles Tirrett, Moss Bros, or Moss as they're now known, and Gandhi's, for sourcing and development and design of products. Mm-hmm. So I was often on a plane going to everywhere from Peru to Bangladesh to Vietnam to Italy to Romania. And it was at that point during the journey that I felt that the industry needed a different approach, especially in menswear, which is where my expertise lay.
Okay, perfect. And I think we're going to spend a bit of time today talking about what that different approach is, how it manifests itself in the way that you work, and you know, most pertinently for our audience, the direction that you're setting can offer some learnings to the wider industry and can offer some guidance, I think, in terms of how you approach things. So let's start off by talking about Neem with a definition of what constitutes slow fashion and what that term means to you. There's the obvious like diametric contrast with fast fashion, but I think in practical terms, slow fashion is also different to what we think of as the average state of the industry. Because fashion in general, and I'm aware we're talking menswear specifically here, but fashion in general feels like it's rushing to scale a really precarious business model sometimes. And it's one that's bigger than having a narrow lens on a couple of companies, you know, your worst offenders, depending on your perspective on fast fashion, can capture. So what does it mean to you, and how does it differ from where the industry is at on aggregate?
Yeah, good question. So to me, slow fashion really came from slow food, so slow food movement, that probably started 15, 20 years ago, has grown. So in terms of slow fashion, full traceability of supply chain right back to farm is paramount. So you need to know your supply chain and know the methods right down to farmer, and then how the farmer is operating the land in order to cultivate the crop. And then from journey thereafter, from spinner to weaver to maker, and then to warehouse and shop, you're tracking that. So full traceability, firstly. Secondly, measurement of supply chain in some way. So understanding impact, both in terms of carbon emissions, water usage, or at a farming level, biodiversity improvements. And then finally, creating products that are less transitional, so trying to create products that can be worn for 9 months of the year, which as we scale become more of a challenge, but wearing products that are as good as a layer in winter as they are as a single layer in summer, and not to push seasonality as much. But if you are pushing seasonality, you're pushing it in a way that is relevant to the season, of course, but also in a way that a product that can be worn for a longer period of the year and ideally can be remarketed. Slowing down of the system through understanding the supply chain and slowing down of the seasons in order to not force unnecessary consumption.
Which makes sense. And it's that kind of like the proactive part of it that I think is the doubly interesting one, where it's not just taking the established model and just kind of passively having it run slower, but it's proactively influencing the way people consume through planning and assortments and putting together kind of what you call like transitional modular styles, things that are designed to kind of step outside the traditional cycle as well. So slowing it down from the outside as well as from the inside.
Exactly right. So creating more transitional garments that could be worn all year. And if you are going to create a product that is highly seasonal, you know, a heavy winter coat or a very lightweight linen, buying that product in a volume that buys to sell out. So keeping the stock lean and using systems such as pre-order or anticipated demand that then doesn't force unnecessary consumption through deep discounting and panicked buying.
Okay, cool. I think that leads us to the question of kind of product creation, sourcing, and production. Because when you think about the typical fashion model, so much of what happens upstream is built on the idea that the only way this all works is to just keep scaling upwards, to keep doing things faster, to keep building more volume, more variety, making big long-term commitments to massive orders. How have you approached finding partners in materials and manufacturing, especially ones closer to home, who are open to looking at things a bit differently and stepping aside from that cycle?
So I was lucky in that, having worked in men's fashion for 20 odd years, I had some history and also contacts that allowed me to speak to people that I thought cared about a new system. So predominantly we operate out of Italy for spinning, weaving and making. And then we also make a little bit in Portugal, a little bit in Romania. And then we farm quite a lot of cotton in Turkey. And then we recycle quite a lot of our cotton in Spain. So in terms of finding makers and producers, there were three approaches. One was that they had to care about the model. So, and that was just talking to them about what we were trying to do with measuring the carbon impact of the product, working with recycled fibers or regeneratively farmed fibers. And then, of course, that then rules out a lot of people, but rules in some. And then secondly, we work with makers that are predominantly or fully operating on renewable energy, and that rules out again a load. And then thirdly, that they were prepared to support us, really. And what I mean by support is that that they can offer you credit. You know, as a small business, you need to be, in order to slow down the system, you need to be buying a small and controlled quantity of product that you are not panic selling through discounting margin, because you've got to pay the supplier back within a very unnecessary time frame, but based on the rate of sale that you can generate as a small business. So there are, unfortunately, in the UK, it's quite difficult for UK manufacturers to support businesses because there just isn't the infrastructure. Whereas in Italy, the size of quantities that we're placing meant that they were able to support. We've always paid, we always do pay. But if we have to pay a significant amount of cash up front, it then forces us into shorting the margin and driving silly discounts. So those three areas, really. They were working with the type of fibres that we wanted. Secondly, that they were renewably powered. And then thirdly, that they believed in what we were trying to do. So therefore, were financially willing to support us, albeit it was a very small financial involvement.
Perfect. So it was effectively like a series of filters that gets you to the stage where that almost identifies the partners automatically that are ready for this kind of journey and prepared for it, and that they're able to adjust their own kind of predictions and business models and things around it.
That's right. So if you're starting from zero, you have to work with people that understand how difficult starting from zero is, and they're prepared to stand by you, but they believe in the overall concept. They believe in the team that we've built. They believe in the brand that we're building. So this isn't a get rich quick scheme. This is a 10-year plan to steal and grow market share in a way that is more responsible and more considered and offers a new system.
That's a great way of putting it. When we think back to what you said, one of the pillars you talked about in slow fashion, which was the kind of farm forward traceability. What's your perspective on regulations? Because I think the rollout of digital product passports, you know, your DPPs, it definitely has brands asking themselves a lot of questions about disclosure, which seems on the surface like a positive outcome. I think the answer to a lot of those questions when people ask them is where they arrive at is we don't have the information to disclose in the first place because we do not have that level of traceability. It's not architected into the way that we work. It's not architected into our supply chain. Do you think legislation is actually providing a meaningful framework and a decent set of incentives for that to change? Or is it more of a moving target that's more useful in spirit than in letter?
So I have very mixed views on legislation. So I think as a small to medium-sized business, I'm against legislation, actually. I think legislation introduces bureaucracy, unnecessary management, and therefore you're not focusing on what is required. And that is an understanding of your supply chain right back to farm, a critical analysis of your supply chain in a way that is collaborative and improving, and a search towards products that are cleaner, circular. And that's where the effort needs to be, rather than on form filling and pushing problems down your supply chain. So legislation in small and medium-sized businesses, I think, creates bureaucracy that the business does not need. In a larger business, let's say 250 million plus, I think legislation is helpful because it forces systematic change. But that systematic change has to be considered in a way that does drive consumption in a cleaner and more ethical way. And the danger is that when bureaucrats are one or two steps removed from actually creating a product that sells and also it sells in a way that is cleaner, more responsible, more ethical, that because they're two steps away, they're not able to actually influence the manufacturers or the retailers correctly because they're just not close enough to it. So in summary, I feel that retailers have to do what they believe is right, and there should be enough of us believing that fairer working practices, paying a living wage, working with farmers to create products that or crops that improve soil fertility and health and biodiversity, working with makers that are using renewable energy, unless you're of the Trump hoax view, that then create products that people want to buy and feel proud of wearing. As a buyer stroke designer stroke director of a business, the product has to be of high design, high durability, but our job is to create products that are cleaner and circular and the consumers want to buy. Legislation is potentially employing people in areas that aren't focused on the actual product or the supply chain, but on bureaucracy and management of paperwork, which I'm not sure is, in my view, focused in the right way.
That's a good answer. When you think about products that are cleaner, and when you think about what that means to the buyer, a lot of your products are labeled with impact reduction figures in what I describe as kind of relatable and tangible form, such as you look at a style and you'll see the volume of carbon emissions from driving saved, for example, as an indicator. Ways of translating some abstract feeling concepts into something more tangible, touch points that people are familiar with in their day-to-day life. What methodology do you use to calculate some of that? And do you think consumers at large, within Neem's own demographic, but maybe beyond as well, are going to value that kind of through line from understanding their buying choices and relating those to other areas of behavioral change?
Yes, so there's two questions there. I mean, firstly, we work with a company called Green Story that are in a Indian tech business who employ textile scientists, and we study the supply chain with them, and then they analyze the impact using various methods, including HIG, but others, and they estimate through pulling out energy certificates, tracking the supply chain, but back to source, and then comparing that to average or mean data that they can pull, what the differences are. And then we look to improve that yearly through moving makers to renewable power or better fibers or better processes. So Green Story are the company that we work with there, who were very retail consumer focused, but have now focused much more on manufacturers, because retailers are tending to push their problems onto manufacturers, and therefore they feel that that's where the business will grow. In terms of consumer impact, there's a percentage of our customer base that is net zero focused and is motivated by that through often what they do on a 9-to-5 basis. So, they might have worked for BP, they work for Octopus, they might have worked in, cement led architecture. They now try and work in low waste architecture. That they might be landscape architects, so they're outside a lot and they can see climate change. They might be farmers, they might work for DEFRA. So there's a percentage of the customers that are just interested or involved and engaged in net zero, and seeing a brand such as ours offering a net zero product, they are interested. But ultimately, the design has to drive sales. So my sense on this is pretty simple. Product leads, and then impact drives repeat purchase. So the fact that we carbon offset all scope 3, because we measure scope 3 through a working with Green Story, and then we offset that and invest in climate mitigation schemes. And then also we take the product back at end of life and then work with Spanish companies to downcycle that. They then engaged and then more likely to repeat purchase. But in order for us to steal market share from other more polluting businesses, our product has to competitively stand up in both in terms of design and cost.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty consistent message coming out here, is that the product is what determines the outcome here, and then the impact reduction and everything else modeled around it is, the product is the vehicle for the change, and people have to believe in the vehicle and they have to want it.
That's right, exactly right. So there are some customers of ours that really care about net zero, and there are others that don't really care and they just like the product. And we're heavily targeting a Gen X audience. So before I launched the brand, I did a lot of research to study into where there was climate interest or climate mitigation interest. And Gen X actually beat Gen Z or millennials, because that demographic, whilst might be interested when it actually comes to consumer spending, they're still building up their wardrobe. And then other than resale or secondhand, they just want to look good for the festival, for the wedding, for the date, for the prom, and are then likely to sacrifice any views that they have. Whereas Gen X, because they've already built up a wardrobe, they're buying less but buying better quality. They want to buy something that really does have a meaning.
Well, as somebody who is, depending on the definition, an older millennial or a younger Gen X, I feel that tension. I've seen myself. Fine. So those labels then. So the kind of tangible, relatable stuff, I think rightly focuses on the environmental impact of the product. But we've written a few times at the Interline about this. The human beings in the garment supply chain are often left out of impact quantification and communication strategies. Now, you mentioned at the top that you spent a lot of time working with mainstream brands, and I know you came away disillusioned, to put it mildly, with how the industry treats its suppliers. When you think about everything you said about how much choice and selection and expertise and experience lives with vendors and partners upstream, what do you think needs to change in order for fashion brands in general to start to better recognize and compensate the value and the humanity of the people who work upstream of them?
Well, that's a big question. I think in terms of people, a determination to pay living wage, not minimum wage, should be a motivator in larger businesses. Secondly, to use technology within the home domestic country to reduce fixed costs, which unfortunately might be employing fewer people, to there use technology to reduce fixed costs. So therefore the burden on margin is reduced, and therefore you can pay more of a living wage outside the UK, and then to assess and audit your factories using whichever system you feel is right. Now, in terms of social responsibility, I think a lot of work's been done in this area in the last 20 years. So whilst there will still be hiccups, I think whether it's big events such as Rana Plaza, or smaller events such as I think things were uncovered in Leicester, I think retailers actually have come a long way in social working practices. I think there's still a greed to move from factory to factory for small pennies and margin growth, and to focus very much on the costs rather than the net margin. So too quick to discount, too quick to overbuy, too quick to become fat and bloated on the domestic end, rather than control those costs more and then to pay a bit more and work with suppliers and grow with makers and suppliers. But generally, I think that this area has improved in the last 15, 20 years or since I've been, you know, going to factories around the world.
Okay, that's encouraging to hear. And I think as well, like when you talked about the multi-filter sort of model that you have for selecting partners and suppliers, it doesn't lend itself, it's almost inimical to that idea of just shifting around and moving as quick as possible to chase the cheapest needle, as the saying goes. The two are not necessarily compatible with one another. And I think the sooner the wider industry rolls those two things together, you probably start to see even more tangible progress there.
Yeah. I think the business, I mean, it's a separate podcast, really, but the business is inherently inefficient in terms of communication and management. I think there are some businesses that are efficient and therefore they've scaled because they've kept the fixed costs low. But generally, it's quite a bloated industry and quite inefficient in terms of sampling and courier costs and flying stock in and buying too late and not managing inventory. And I think technology has improved all of those areas I've just mentioned, and that should allow fixed costs to reduce, and therefore you can invest more in product and then the supply chain. Whereas the last 40 years, through the growth of man-made fibres, we've seen a focus on trying to push problems down the supply chain. So if my margin's not good enough, well, I demand a lower cost or I'm going to move factory. If I need auditing, well, supplier, you could just do this and send us the information. So pushing too many problems down to manufacturers in Bangladesh, Vietnam and elsewhere in the world, rather than working with them on improving systems together. Of course, there are some retailers that are shining examples here.
Yeah. Well, when we come around to doing an efficiency episode, which we need to do, we'll have you back for that, because that's the one's overdue from my side as well. Moving on slightly, so you recently kicked off a collection of regenerative knitwear with a fully domestic supply chain, which I feel like has a lot of the little pieces of sustainability and circularity and things we've talked about so far in microcosm. Quickly, if you wouldn't mind, walk us through what you've learned from that collection and that process.
Yeah, so we work with a regenerative cotton that we grow in southwest Turkey, directly back to farm, and then we work with regenerative farm merino. Now, regenerative is an unclear term, so in my eyes, what it means is improvement of soil health and improving biodiversity above and below ground and measuring that soil health and biodiversity. So it's not necessarily a ban on inputs, but you need to measure if your soil health is improving in order to have more maggots and worms in the soil and more birds above the soil, and therefore to grow a healthier plant or animal that leads to a better product. So we work with regenerative merino and cotton, and then we're now developing a product which is a British wool from 260 sheep in Somerset in the Mendips. And these are sheep that have been crossbred over the last 6-7 years to create a type of sheep that is a more lustrous and softer yarn, close to merino, but not as the same as merino. But it creates a product that isn't itchy, it's softer, it's breathable. And again, it's regeneratively farmed. There are various accreditations for regenerative farming. And then we spin that in the UK and then we make that in the UK. In terms of what I've learned, UK manufacturing is hard. I don't think this business is industry is built for it. I think anyone who feels otherwise is a bit naive. Unfortunately, the infrastructure isn't there. I think if large retailers have responsibility with UK manufacturing to try and support a program over a 3-5 year period, invest in the industry. But as a smaller manufacturer, retailer, it's very difficult to work with UK manufacturers because of the fact that they're all off operating on wafer thin margins and aren't capitalized and don't have significant orders that they can be assured of from season to season, and therefore are vulnerable. And as a small business, it's difficult to operate in that way, that the manufacturers are changing size and they're descaling and they're facing national insurance pressures, they're facing energy bills. It's not a great country, I don't think, to be manufacturing in. So whilst we try and do a bit of Made in Britain with socks and then this knitwear range, it's a tough, we've got to create a product that is commercial at the right price and is going to sell. And we will have to short our margin on this product in order to enable it to sell. And we'll tell a great story. The story is deep and it's right to farm. I was shearing the sheep. Myself, I learned how to shear, which was super fun. I'm in touch with the farmers directly. I think it's medium or larger size retailers' responsibility to invest in UK manufacturing rather than small businesses.
Well, I think as well, the challenge of a lot of this is for domestic production to make sense, that people always kind of mention reinvention as being synonymous with that, like a different way of working. It's hard to reinvent yourself if you don't have stable foundations and you don't have the luxury of time in that kind of thing. So it's I can see how that's a precarious position for domestic manufacturing here in the UK.
Yeah, it's the infrastructure isn't here. Now, having said that, the infrastructure is close by. Portugal is invested, Italy is invested, and then parts of Eastern Europe are invested, as well as Northern Africa. So anyone, thinking of starting a brand, I would be wary of UK manufacturing if I were you, but try and do something in the UK because it's easy to manage and stay in touch and supervise. But I think it's a responsibility of large retailers to invest in it because the government aren't going to step in and help. And so therefore, larger retailers should be sort of creating Made in Britain collections. I know, and it has to be over a 3 or 4 year period. So there's forecasted budgetary income and production capacity that manufacturers can build on.
Cool. You've now mentioned the magic government word, so that means we're now locked into 3 episodes. One, this one, efficiency, and then government support. Fine, moving us on. So I know you also design with kind of recycling and longevity and disassembly and things in mind. I'll ask you for a quick answer just because it's a big topic that could go on a long time. But what does it look like, practically speaking, to bring end-of-life considerations into product creation?
So we do two things, really. We make sure that all the products that we design, or at least 90% of the products that we design, can be recycled at end of life. And then, so that's just a testing that product with the recycler that we work with to ensure that after multiple washing and wears, they can actually break that fiber down and recycle. And then we take product back at end of life. We have a QR code, which has digital passport in, which is just fairly basic proprietary technology, but we also work with Green Story on that, or are working with Green Story to improve it, but at the moment it's basic proprietary technology. And we take the product back and then we batch that up, and we get, when we get to 250 kilos, because we take any brand, any condition, and we offer credit on that to then drive sales into Neem. And I have a very simple view: any sale from Neem is a cleaner sale than it is from probably the retailer, maybe not always, but probably the retailer down the road. So we take any brand, any condition. When we get to 250 kilos, we batch it up, we send it to Spain, and then we work with two partners in Spain who recycle or downcycle. We also resell. So Neem that comes back post consumer use, and non-Neem, so any brand that they've sent us, and then we issue them a credit. We also resell some of that. At the moment, that resell is only in our shop, and it does well. We even had Harry Styles buy one a couple of weeks ago. So we have a resale secondhand rail, and then at some point we will put that online. The labor costs, the unit costs here, you need to be very careful of. You asked for a short answer, didn't you? I'm going on a bit. But so, yeah, the unit cost here of recycling and downcycling, you need to be careful of. So our view on this is we're driving new purchases through a recruitment scheme, which is offering credit. So 95% of customers who give us old clothing, whether it's Neem or non-Neem, then go on to buy. So that's a recruitment exercise to bring back product. You can only operate recycling and downcycling if you're working with volume. So as I say, we need to get to a quarter of a ton, which we do about 3-4 times a year, and then we send that back to Spain. And of course, sending it back and then dealing with it and managing it and then ensuring that it's not exported outside the EU does take time, energy and money. So you need to work with volume in order to bring the unit costs down, and also you need to drive new sales, which has a healthy margin. At the moment, we double our investments into climate mitigation schemes at various points of the year. But the advantage we have is that the product that we get back that's non-Neem, that can be resold, as I say, we do resell a proportion of it, because a lot of it isn't resaleable. It has to be recycled or downcycled. But that resale is mostly pure profit. So that helps with the financial modelling. But in order to, this has been a 4-year programme really since we launched, and it was always our vision that we wanted to take non-Neem. We want to be textile waste clothing collectors, and we want to get to a volume that is forecastable, as in we know how many kilos we're getting back per week. So then we are able to then work with recyclers, because they know how many units they're going to get from us. But there has to be an underlying focus on driving new sales in order to pay for the textile collection.
Yeah, the two business models can't be in fundamental tension with one another. As you said, you are at the end of the day becoming profitable and targeting new sales from that. I think people do often frame some circularity and end of life stuff as a risk to the new sale business model, but I think yours is a good example of the fact that the two can kind of feed one another.
That's right. Yeah, we see the collection of textiles as a recruitment exercise. It triggers purchase, allows deep narrative storytelling, and it ensures that we work hard on making sure that the textile we collect is managed in a responsible way. It would be easy for us just to give the quarter of a ton every few months to a charity that would take it for free and may not be able to guarantee that they're not exporting it outside the EU.
Yeah, exactly.
We want to make sure that any textile that we collect is managed within the EU.
Okay, cool. Shifting gears slightly. So as a tech publication, we're always keen to know where brands have employed technology to solve quantifiable problems. I'm going to pick one example for you. So I know you've worked with 3D / DPC, digital product creation, as we call it, tools as a way to reduce waste. Tell me a bit more about that. How did that pan out? And do you have any examples of technology areas where you piloted something and maybe it didn't work out?
Yeah, so we work with 3D design. We'd love to work with 3D design all the time. At this point, we just can't afford to, because we don't have an in-house full-time employee that does it, nor can we afford to. So there's a proportion of the products that we've developed that we have designed in 3D, Chloe, for example. We then ask the customer to vote on which style they would like us to put into production using 3D, so zero sampling. And then with that, and we engage them on that, and we do a number of votes both on email and on social. Email is much more responsive for us. And then we put that product on the website and we take sales before we've made a simple sample. Yeah. And we've proven that that model with the 3D technology and there's one on the product on the site at the moment. There's a tan and camel chet. There's another one that's about to go on next week, a chambray. We haven't made a sample yet, but we're taking pre-order and we've taken some sales. And we would love to do that on 70-80% of our range. Just can't afford to yet, but our plan is that we will 3D model everything before we sample. We'll ask for the customer's response on most, and also we'll put it on the site with pre-order. So pre-order has worked for us. It comes with customer service and delivery challenges at times, and 3D modeling has really worked for us. The other tech areas that work for us is just the QR code, which has a batch ID level inbuilt into the product, so it's a basic product passport. That's been good for us, so we can scan a product and we know when it was made and when it was shipped. But I think the problems in a small business with technology is that you can get caught up in things, and probably any size of business for that matter, get caught up in things that aren't actually going to drive consumer interest or revenue growth. So 3D is an example of something that does drive revenue. Digital product passports and product IDs are an area that can be a bit of a black hole of interest, but you're not focusing on, you know, improving your Meta ads and your Google ads and your selling in store and your customer service, all of which do drive sales.
Yeah, and I think that really answers my next question, which was going to be about where you would recommend brands of a comparable size to yours prioritize their investments in tech, talent, relationships, marketing, and so on. Because I think the answer, correctly, is what's going to drive revenue growth, what's going to move the needle and help you to further your vision as a company, but specifically at the product level.
Yeah, you invest in good product, well-marketed with a good story and at a good margin, and that will help you drive the business. So in terms of technology, using obvious bits of technology like Shopify, like Xero, like Klaviyo, Google Analytics. And then if you're built on a cleaner system as a startup, try and develop digital product passports in-house, which is not that complicated. And know your supply chain, because the more you know about the supply chain, the more you can influence it and the more you can tell a story around it.
That's an interesting one, the DPPs in-house. One for a future chat. Final question, because I think it's an inevitable one whenever we've spoken with a brand like yours that has what you might define as kind of an alternative business model, one that's slightly out of lockstep with the way the wider industry works. And that question is, you know, can what you're doing scale and should it? Because I think big companies will often look at brands like yours and they'll file them away and sort of say, well, that's an experiment. It only works because it's constrained and narrow in scope. Are they right, or are they missing the point of what you're trying to do?
They're missing the point. Of course, we can scale because we're creating good products that people want to wear at a reasonable margin. Durability of products that last, and just a style that people want to buy into. What we're doing underneath that is creating products that are cleaner, thought through, considered, take back. As long as you don't get distracted by financial black holes, such as the take back or an unwavering commitment to cleaner, there have to be some compromises, because without profitability, we are not sustainable. And without sustainable profitability, we can't create a more sustainable solution. So at times there have to be compromises, and you have to accept that whilst growing the business. Without a doubt, life cycle assessments, taking product back at end of life and using cleaner fibers and knowing your supply chain, if those are the simple ticks, should be worked on by medium to large size retailers. And that doesn't mean to say that you need to change your business model. It means that you just need to work towards those things, which is possible. You can take product back and then profit out of that product rather than letting eBay and Vinted profit from it. You can study your supply chain to know right down to farm, not on every product, but on some products. You can start to run life cycle assessments on those products where you know the supply chain. You can move towards slightly better fibres. You have to control your costs internally, so it allows you to remove polyesters and other products from the range. But unfortunately, at times you've got to also create product that people are prepared to buy at a price that they're prepared to buy it at. So don't try and be too perfect. Improve and operate in a more efficient way.
I think that perfection paralysis is a very real and tangible thing across the industry. So that's a good place to bring us to a close. Nick, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, man. Thanks very much. Great fun. And hopefully see you again next time.
Yeah, perfect. Looking forward to it. That's the end of my conversation with Nick. Thank you for listening. It's great to be back in the host seat for the Interline podcast. You're going to notice a lot more episodes coming from us in the very near future on a more regular cadence. And we've got some really interesting guests lined up in a bunch of different areas. There's a lot more to come in sustainability and circularity. There's a lot to come in digital product creation. There's a lot to come in AI. Basically, the kinds of conversations that I love having out in the world and on stage at the wonderful event partnerships and things we have. I'm going to be having a lot more of them remotely because they're the conversations I want to have, and selfishly they're conversations I enjoy having, and I feel like they advance my own understanding of the industry, and hopefully they give you folks on the other end of the podcast something interesting to listen to, some inspiration for how you might change things in your business, and some framing for where technology and fashion and technology and beauty increasingly are interacting. So it's great to be back and looking forward to talking to you all more often. Thanks for listening.